This is an ABC podcast.
When is a tax not a tax? When it's one you don't have to pay ever. We'll come back to the tax that isn't a tax a bit later. Hello, I'm Richard Ady. Welcome to The Money. Let's begin with the cost of living. Inflation's now at 5.1%, hasn't been that high for more than 20 years, and it could be a problem for the government in this election. It means that even more than normal, what the Reserve Bank does to the cash rate, the base of all interest rates, will be headline news. Warren Hogan's economic advisor to Judo Bank. Warren, what do the inflation figures mean for the RBA?
They mean that they don't really have much more flexibility, that they have to start normalising monetary policy. And what I mean by that is to take the interest rate, which is now 0.1% for their overnight cash rate, back to something more normal, which is probably something around 2% to 3%. And given how sharp the increase was in inflation, the broad-based nature of the price rises across the economy, and the fact that inflation is so far above their target at 5% versus their target of 2% to 3%, they really can't sort of wait any longer. They need to start that process. They don't need to rush, and they won't, but they need to essentially join the global bandwagon of rate hikes and taking those interest rates upwards a little bit.
So that means Tuesday? Is that what you're thinking?
I do. I think these numbers are so high, and essentially the risks are shifting so quickly towards sort of inflation getting away from not just us but all around the world, that they just can't wait. So I think Tuesday they should start. There's no real reason to wait other than that there's an election, which I think the RBA have said many times in the past, that's not a reason. So I think Tuesday they'll start the process, and really the debate becomes in the lead up to that decision whether they do a very small increase of 15 basis points or 0.15%, or whether they go 40 basis points or 0.4%. And the reason that is the debate is because their current interest rate at 0.1% is out of whack with their normal cycle where they tend to move in 0.25% increments.
Because, as you've already alluded to, it's not that long ago they were thinking 2024. And you mentioned what's happening around the world. Philip Lowe has actually been at pains to convey that the RBA considered Australia to be different from the rest of the world when it comes to inflation. But it does now look as if events have caught up.
His argument for us being different was based on two facts. And one was that our domestic energy prices were not rising like they were seeing in the US and the UK, i.e. electricity prices. And of course, that is a ubiquitous input into production, into everything, services, goods, households. And of course, that's a risk of driving inflation in a broad-based manner. And we weren't getting that. So that was the first point. And the other point he made was that our wage-setting practices are different. Our labour market is stickier or slower to react to economic circumstances. And therefore, the ultimate driver of inflation over time being wages growth was unlikely to respond quickly to this pandemic price shock which we've received. So he saw these two features as being a reason we had flexibility, we had time on our side. It remains to be seen whether their view is right. We can't confirm or not how wages are responding to these economic conditions. But the reality is that inflation now is rising so much and so far above their target, they don't really have that flexibility to wait and be patient to see how the labour market responds. But I would add that anecdotally, and what we're hearing from businesses and what we're reading in the newspapers and hearing on radio, is that wages are starting to move because unemployment is approaching a 50-year low. So it's just this balance of risks to the outlook that has shifted. And essentially, that's how they have to set their monetary policy. It is always going to be, I hate to say, an element of guesswork. It's risk management. They can't wait until they know exactly what's happening because it'll be too late. And in the case of rising inflation, if you wait until you confirm that wages are there and you confirm that this is becoming entrenched in the economy, it will be entrenched and wages will be rising at a pace that's unsustainable, and the only alternative will be to put the economy into recession like we saw in the United States in the early 80s and like we had in Australia in the early 90s.
There's sort of a Goldilocks time, isn't there? If they've been holding off, but they don't want to go too late. I'll come back to the RBA in a minute, Warren. I'm thinking about the huge amount of money that is due to enter the economy has already started between now and September, including millions of people getting a $1,500 tax cut. What is going to be the effect of that?
Well, it's inflationary. It is. And it's what I've described in recent times as pure fiscal stimulus. And the reason I call it pure fiscal stimulus is because you're literally giving people money who are more than likely going to spend it all immediately. It's unlikely to be saved. And so it will add into demand in the economy. And this latest budget, which sought to offset the cost of living pressures, is utterly admirable. You know, the budget is benefiting from very high energy prices through taxation, and to use some of those funds that the government is receiving to help those less fortunate in the community who are being heavily affected, I think not many people would argue with that. That it will make the task of getting inflation under control more difficult.
I'm sure you've had a go at the maths on this. Where do you think inflation will get to?
One of the other rationales for us being different is that our inflation has been lower, even than countries like New Zealand and Canada. But my work on this suggests we're just lagging. It's happening here later than the rest of the world. So we can see right now that in other countries, inflation is peaking, or we hope it's peaking, or getting to a high point of around somewhere between 6 and 8%. I think the US is 8.5%. New Zealand's near 7, UK is 7. I think that's where we'll end up. And I think we'll end up there in Q3, maybe Q4.
Both the Treasurer and the Shadow Treasurer agree that the bank should be subject to a review after the election. I think it's been about 40 years since anyone last did this. what are the key questions to answer here?
Well, I think if they're going to go to the effort and cost of doing this, they do it in a broad-based manner. They need to get proper people doing it. And what I mean by that is they need a good mix of monetary policy experts and bankers. It is a bank, after all, at the part of what it does, the RBA. They need to review the performance. And essentially, to cut to the chase, because I have a strong view on this, is that the RBA has done a great job. Inflation targeting is the right thing to do. The RBA actually instigated inflation targeting of 2 to 3%, well, formally in 96, but practically in 1993, I think it was, in a way that was much more flexible and much more pragmatic than any other central bank. I don't believe inflation targeting is past its use-by date. It's exactly what central banks should be doing. I think the problem of the last 30 years is that central banks have essentially become rock stars. Politicians are being increasingly unable to deliver tough economic reform. And too much pressure is being put on central banks to solve our economic problems. They actually have very limited capacity. All they can really do is adjust the interest rate of money supply to help keep inflation under control.
Yeah, they've got two levers.
A lot more of them. They've got their mouth and they've got interest rates.
That's it.
And they're very credible. I actually think we've got to go back to the future here. We've got to put the central banks back into the dark shadows. They don't know the future, and the greatest example of that was the RBA talking about forward guidance last year. They've got egg on their face, talking about cash rates staying where it was to 2024. They don't know what's going to happen in the future any more than any of us do. They have better economists, or more of them at least, but they still don't know. The review needs to focus on, I think, what tweaks can be made, because the model is exceptionally good. I don't think they've done a great job in the last 18 months because they've started to get into this unconventional policy. I think this is a danger that's presented all around the world. I think that needs to be investigated and interrogated at length as part of this review. But to cut to the chase, I think we need to just widen our inflation band from 2 to 3 to 1 to 3. That is to just give them a bit more wiggle room. I think low and stable inflation is a bedrock of Australia's modern economic prosperity, and we would be remiss to walk away from that. I think bank regulation needs to go back to the RBA, so APRA needs to go back into the RBA. I think that separation is misguided. And then I think finally, I think the structure of their board needs to be reviewed. And I think what we're seeing in the last 18 months is a lack of alternative economic views on that board, i.e. having business people, because I do think the RBA has had probably its worst period in its modern history in the last 12 months. And I don't think that's because of the structures. I think it's because there wasn't enough economists with experience in pragmatic economic issues, as opposed to academics, I should say, on that board, making a case against what they're doing. So I just think they need to stick a couple more experienced economists on the board. Some business people are important, I think, but union movement, academics, there needs to be a good mix. But at the moment, it's essentially one academic and a bunch of business people. I think they need some proper economists on there.
Well, we'll watch to see what actually does happen later in the year with interest. Warren, thank you very much for joining us today on The
Thanks
Money.
Thanks for having me on, Richard.
Warren Hogan, and this is The Money with me, Richard Ady. The deal between the Solomon Islands and China means our relationship with the Pacific is under the spotlight. And that was added to this week when Labor released its Pacific policy. The headline from that was an additional $500 million in aid. To get an idea of what this means, I spoke to Professor Stephen House, Director of the Development Policy Centre at the Australian National University.
Well, it's $500 million over 4 years. So that's about $125 million a year. Currently, aid to the Pacific's about $1.8 billion a year, so it's a 7% increase, which I'd say it's significant, but not huge. Perhaps what's more important about it, though, rather than the magnitude, is that Labor has said it's new money, it's additional aid, and so far the coalition's been funding their increases in aid to the Pacific by taking aid from other countries, so that would be a significant shift. Labor's also said it's going to be making some further non-Pacific aid announcements, so we need to wait to hear those as well.
You've already touched on this, but nothing much has been said about foreign aid to other parts of the world. Is this a trend when it comes to Australia's foreign aid?
Yeah, it certainly is increasingly focused on the Pacific. So if we take the share of aid, of all our aid that goes to the Pacific and to Timor-Leste, because I think unofficially Timor-Leste is sort of part of the Pacific step-up. So when the coalition came to power, that share was less than 25%. Of the aid program, that's in 2013, and now it's almost 45%. So that's a huge change.
Absolutely. We've seen the fallout of this agreement very recently between the Solomon Islands and China. How much of the increasing aid focus on the Pacific is about other countries and I suppose specifically China?
Yeah, I think definitely China's played a big role in this. We've been talking about how the share to the Pacific's been increasing over the last decade. But if we look at the decade before that, the share of aid going to the Pacific was actually in decline. So it had been around 35% in the 1990s, and that fell to that low that I mentioned of just below 25% about a decade ago. So it wasn't that aid to the Pacific was being cut, but that was a period, the earlier period, was one in which we were expanding total aid. And the thinking then was that, well, the Pacific's already getting a lot of aid. In fact, the Pacific is the most aid-dependent region in the world. And so the thinking was, well, yes, it will always need aid, but there's not going to be a high return from giving it more aid. So back then, when we were expanding the total aid program, it was largely outside of the Pacific. But now it's the opposite. And so if you ask yourself what's changed, what's caused this real reversal, I think there is only one answer. And that is the rise of China and that sense that now prevails of strategic competition.
How do we compare? If we look at, say, other OECD countries, where are we on in terms of aid?
Well, we're pretty much down the bottom. The metric most commonly used to compare aid across countries is the ratio of aid to gross national income, aid to GNI, the so-called generosity metric. And the idea there is that, you know, obviously bigger or richer countries should give more. So we basically adjust the aid program for the size of the economy. And again, if we go back to the 90s, I mean, Australia, you know, has never really been a leader in terms of aid generosity, but we didn't want to be a laggard either. So then we were consistently in the middle of the group of OECD aid donors. But that's really changed with the big aid cuts that we've seen over the last decade. We've gone to the bottom of the league table. I think it's also, you know, it's worth looking at just total global aid, because global aid has never been higher. And it's actually increased over the last decade by about 25%, adjusting for inflation, which is about how much Australian aid has fallen. So we really do stand out as the exception in terms of our approach to aid rather than the rule.
How much, Stephen, is of the allocation of foreign aid is down to, I suppose, economic modelling, we could do this good here? And how much is about that geopolitical thing, particularly with regard now to China?
Yeah, this is a good question. And I'd say that aid's always been given for a range of reasons. You know, there's always the development or the humanitarian motive. But there's also always been the national interest, whether it's commercial or strategic. I would say, though, that with this new competition with China, that national interest motive is looming larger, which is understandable, but also a concern, I think, from an aid effectiveness point of view, because aid that's good from a strategic perspective, you know, when you're trying to win hearts and minds, is not necessarily aid that's good from a development perspective.
And, of course, as you know, we're an economics show. From an economic point of view, does foreign aid work?
Yeah, well, that is the million-dollar question, and of course, one that's been much debated. My own answer would be that, yeah, I've certainly seen some bad aid projects in my time, but overall, on average, aid does work. It won't make a country rich, but it can make a real difference in the lives of a lot of poor people. But at the same time, I mean, economists like to talk about diminishing returns, and I do think that's a relevant concept here. I mentioned that the Pacific is already the most aid-dependent region in the world, and I think the more aid you give or the more aid you receive, the lower the returns. And at high volumes, aid can have distorting or even negative impacts. So I do think when we think about how we can help our neighbours or interact with them, we do need to think of other economic tools and not only focus on foreign aid.
So what else?
Yeah, well, I think personally the best thing to come out of the Pacific Step Up is not more aid for the Pacific, but a real rise in Pacific labour mobility. So I was talking with you last year, Richard, about Nauru.
Yes.
I mean, Nauru's an extreme case, but it does illustrate the point that the Pacific Islands are not going to follow a conventional route to development. They're just too small, too dispersed. They're never going to become industrial hubs. So the idea with labour mobility is rather than trying to create jobs in the Pacific, you take islanders to where the jobs are. And if we think regionally, well, that's Australia and New Zealand. And there are a lot of advantages, you know, about thinking in terms of labour mobility rather than aid. At the end of the day, aid, however good it is a budgetary cost, whereas labour mobility is actually a benefit to Australia. And we've seen that during COVID. We've needed people to pick fruit and vegetables on our farms. And also in terms of the workers, I mean, the benefits go direct to the households involved. So labour mobility has that direct impact rather than the very indirect impact you hope for with government-to-government aid projects. And also from a strategic perspective, obviously labour mobility is not something China can provide to the Pacific. So I think labour mobility has a lot going for it in the Pacific context, and it really has been boosted by the Pacific Step Up. The first Pacific labour mobility scheme was introduced only in 2007, and we now have more than 20,000 Pacific Islanders currently working in Australia on what's now called the Pacific Australia Labour Mobility Scheme. So I think that's a very exciting development. And just to go back, you mentioned at the start the recent Labour announcement on more aid to the Pacific. They also made announcements about further expanding Pacific labour mobility, including for the first time to introduce a Pacific window into our permanent migration regime. So far, the Pacific labour schemes have been temporary in nature. Labour's proposing now that we expand the menu to also think about permanent Pacific migration, and that would really grow the Pacific diaspora in Australia. And I think that could really be a game changer and do a lot more good than any additional amount of aid.
That's beyond an economic multiplier. I mean, if you look at New Zealand, if you spend any time in Auckland especially, it feels like a Pacific city in a way that no Australian city does in the same way. New Zealand has deep, long-term ties with the Pacific because of that. And I think they're probably seen as a better actor in the Pacific than we are. It's a different country with a different outlook.
No, I think you're absolutely right. I mean, labour mobility does have clear economic benefits, but as you say, the benefits go well beyond the economic. And if you just look at the numbers in terms of the Pacific diaspora in New Zealand as a percentage of the population, I think it's close to 9%, whereas in Australia, it's about 1%. So, yeah, that's the difference. And if we really do want to be part of the Pacific family, which is what everyone is talking about now, we really need to grow the Pacific diaspora in Australia, and it'll benefit the Pacific Islands as well. Given the nature of their economies, as I mentioned. So, yeah, I think it's exciting what's happened so far, but this Labour announcement I think is very promising.
Stephen, always good to get your insights. Thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you, Richard.
Stephen Howes from the ANU. I'm Richard Adie. This is The Money on Radio National, wherever you get your podcasts. Now to the tax that is not a tax. It's called the Petroleum Resource Rent Tax, the PRRT, and it is spectacularly bad at actually raising money, so much so that Shell, owner of 25% of the giant Gorgon gas field off WA, expects to pay no PRRT on it ever. The Greens have launched a tax policy that would change that. So we asked Diane Kral, who's at the Monash Business School and an expert on this, to have a look at it.
So the Greens' policy is to repair the Petroleum Resource Rent Tax, or PRRT, for offshore gas, to add a royalty levy to offshore gas that is not subject to a royalty at the moment, except for the Northwest Shelf of Karratha. So first of all, with the royalty revenue, they're suggesting 10%, and that will be levied on the wellhead value of gas produced. So in other words, whatever gas comes out of the pipe, it's got an accepted market value, and you multiply the volume by the value and then apply the 10% royalty. And then they suggest that the royalties be creditable against the PRRT and income tax deductible, which is not unusual. Now, so that's the first component. The second component is repairing the PRRT. So first of all, they're going to nominate a date, and from that date, any expenditure, and we're talking operating and capital costs, not yet deducted from PRRT profit, will not be carried forward to future years. And this carried forward figure is a very problematic figure.
I understand that date is actually the 1st of July this year. So this would be a change that happened very quickly if they did it. Do we have an idea of how much these changes would mean in terms of additional taxation revenue?
So from the data that I've seen, had the Parliamentary Budget Office cost it, and looking at $92 billion extra next decade, but that includes revenue from the repaired PRRT, income tax adjustment, as well as the royalty of about $26
million.
Okay. So 92 up, but the royalty component will be $26 billion of that.
All right. So I feel we've gotten slightly ahead of ourselves. Before we get into this a bit more, can you explain what the Petroleum Resource Rent Tax is and how it applies to offshore gas?
So the Petroleum Resource Rent Tax, or the PRRT, is an additional tax on Australian offshore gas resources. So we're talking offshore and we're talking Commonwealth waters. And it is a second taxing of the resources because there's already income tax applied. And it's always justified because it's considered that things such as gas resources are limited and their extraction can only occur once, and so they're valuable, and that justifies the second taxing. And the typical mechanism of a super profits tax in the form of the PRRT uses an above normal tax base as the method of taxing these type of resources. So there's the above normal profits. That's when the tax becomes particularly effective, or becomes effective full stop. And the other feature is that with these projects, there's a lot of capital expended and operating costs incurred before the resource can actually be extracted from wherever it is. So these costs are added together, carried forward with an uplift rate to account for inflation. For instance, it may take 10 years before a particular project comes into production. And so all these costs with interest are carried forward until such time as the resource is extracted and the costs are offset against the revenue.
And I think we're starting to get towards the problem with the PRRT, which is that it's not very good at collecting revenue from these energy resources companies, is it?
Correct. So it's a very, we can say complex tax, because there's all these mechanisms designed to try and allow a company to put all its infrastructure in place, get everything working before they start paying tax. But the problem is there are so many mechanisms, this is where things go wrong.
Yes. And when you get a complex situation, that suits these gigantic companies, which have different legal entities that can buy things from one another. This is something which you're very familiar with, called transfer pricing, but it means that they can quite legally game the system, doesn't it?
They've got the advantage of detailed inside knowledge of how the tax works and how it can be, you know, just subtly changed legally in order to get a better outcome. And every taxpayer's got the right to minimise, you know, their tax liability.
Yeah, but hang on. Shell, which has a 25% stake in the Gorgon Reserve in WA, which is a massive resource, actually said last year that it expected it will never pay a cent in PRRT on gas from Gorgon. Now, it's obviously going to benefit enormously from extracting that gas and selling it in the market, but it's able to happen in a way in which it doesn't generate a profit and it won't pay any PRRT.
Correct. And so, to my way of thinking, that is the problem of the government, in that they've got to design a tax that is more effective. So all Shell are doing is looking at the legislation and saying, well, look, we're following the letter of the law and that is the outcome. So I'm not surprised that over the years for gas, these companies are not required to pay the PRRT. It is up.
Simpler. I think it's also... It would be simpler if we just said, you know what, this PRRT, it's really not working in terms of raising revenue. Let's just have a royalty and we'll charge it, as you say, on the amount when it's extracted on an agreed price.
That's right. That's correct.
Why has there been no effort to reform this in the past? This is not a new problem. We know that other countries like Qatar, for example, make good money out of their PRRTs. We're not making anything out of offshore gas. Why hasn't either the coalition... it's been in power for 9 years, or Labor before that was in for six. Why haven't they done something about this?
Going back to recent times with the coalition, there have been some changes, but not effective enough. So if you recall the Mike Callaghan review of the PRRT, he made a number of recommendations and some were taken up and still not effective. So there was a lot of lobbying by the oil and gas companies for no change to the PRRT because they were benefiting. So the coalition government, in other words, had a lot of pressure and lobbying by the big oil to maintain the status quo. And then going back to the Labor Party, the PRRT was first introduced by the Hawke government. It was a...
It was held up as a good idea.
It was held up as a good idea and it worked because it was applied to oil. That does bring about super profits. We can see the only PRRT really that's been generated is from the oil at Bass Strait, which is basically run out. And the PRRT was not designed for gas because gas requires so much expenditure in terms of liquefaction plants and the ongoing...
Well, colour me cynical, but I am not optimistic about there being huge changes here. Thank you, though, very much, Diane, for joining us today on The Money.
Okay, thank you, Richard.
That's Diane Krall from the Monash Business School. And that is it for this week. The Money is produced by Kate McDonald. Our sound engineer is Tim Jenkins. And I'm Richard Adie.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.